Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So as Republicans all across the country, now they're starting redistricting, right? Even more gerrymandering coming down the road. And, you know, this whole idea that Democrats shouldn't be allowed to vote, it's like just has become the animating force in the Republican Party. And some folks are doing something about it. Thank God. Joe Madison and Al Beshear and a bunch of other folks, Al Sharpton, Martin Luther King Jr. III, and others are marching on Washington, D.C. for voting rights. And our old buddy Joe Madison, the Black Eagle, he's right here on Sirius XM, channel 126, 6 to 10 a.m. every morning. Civil rights, human rights activist. JoeMadison.com is his website. You can tweet him at Madison Sirius XM. Joe, welcome back.
We will be actually gathering at McPherson Square in Washington, D.C., which is adjacent to the Black Lives Matter Plaza downtown, and then striking out to start walking immediately from there about, 10 o'clock to the White House, and in front of the White House, then straight up the street to Pennsylvania Avenue to in front of the Capitol. We'll be at a venue in front of the Capitol, not in front of the Lincoln Memorial. Now, I want to emphasize that because usually these demonstrations have always been in front of the Lincoln Memorial. There's a reason it's going to be in front of the Capitol. That's because this situation, as it relates to the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, used to be H.R. 4, which passed the House, now is in the hands of basically Joe Biden. That's why we're heading down from McPherson Square to the White House and then up Pennsylvania Avenue to near the Capitol, because we want people to see that it is the United States Senate and Congress that can now protect voting, the rights of voting. There are 40-plus states right now, as you know and your audience knows, 40-plus states. I've heard as high, really, as 49 that have legislation that suppresses the vote. And by the way, this is not just the Black vote. This is everybody's vote. That's what's happening. And I'll be co-hosting along with Al Beshear, who, by the way, is now a radio broadcaster, but the young people certainly know him as one of the foremost recording artists and record producers. Yeah. We're doing something about it, man. Look, this matter, and by the way, it doesn't take a supermajority. to get the John Lewis bill passed, the John Lewis voting, what was commonly known as John Lewis voting rights bill passed. It takes a simple majority, and we've got to make sure every Democrat is on votes. And then if that happens, and as we anticipate, probably every Republican will vote against it. It goes into a tie, and then Kamala Harris obviously breaks the tie, which is why voting is important. Can you imagine that here we are in 2021, and the importance of protecting people's right to vote comes down, it could come down, Tom, to one vote.
Yeah.
One vote. I mean, but this is what we're fighting. I mean, and when you talk about, I heard your piece about all these vote, why the Republicans are restricting the vote, Tom, because they can't win if the majority of people vote. And here they are restricting it. We've gone from the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which basically gave people the opportunity to vote in just southern states. This would cover all 50 states. So yes, we're telling people, look, show up, speak up, show up and act out. And we can't give Democrats a pass on this one, and we can't give Biden a pass on this one. And the freaking filibuster is also potentially standing in the way. Here we go again.
Yeah. Finish your thought. I'm sorry. I thought you were done.
No. I was just simply saying, you know, one of the last times the filibuster was used was to prevent the passage of the 64 Civil Rights Bill.
Yep.
And it's like history repeating itself. That's where I was going.
Yeah, and the filibuster was exclusively used from when John C. Calhoun essentially started it in the 1830s up until the Civil War to block any discussion of slavery. They actually passed a law in the House. In the Senate, they just used a rule. And then after the Civil War, from that time until 1965, it was never used for anything except to block civil rights legislation, something that... go ahead.
Yeah, and they tried... No, I was going to say, and you remember they tried to use it for, I think it was initially, for Supreme Court debates,
yeah.
Supreme Court nominee debates, and just recently, correct me if I'm wrong, as it relates to the debate on the budget.
Yep.
Well, here's what the Senate did. Again, check me out on this. Here's what the Senate did. The Senate passed this rule that says, nope, you can't use it as it relates to debate for Supreme Court justice. So they carved out a rule as it relates to the filibuster.
That's right. Mitch McConnell did that. Yep.
There you go. And then they carved out a rule as it relates to the budget. And
yep.
Here's the deal. Why? Because the budget was too important to the country to have, 41 senators or whatever the filibuster rule is, and it's not in the Constitution. You're absolutely right. It's too important. Well, if it's too important as it relates to the budget, if it's too important because of the responsibility of the Senate, which is carved out in the Constitution, then it certainly ought to be carved out so that it's not used to stop people or to restrict people from voting. Amen. This is nothing but, and I've said this again and I'll say it again, this march, ironically, 58 years after the March on Washington against repressive Republican Dixiecrats who wanted to turn back everything from, Social Security to... you name it, minimum wage, the whole agenda. There's a great speech, if your people can find it, a clip from A. Philip Randolph, the founder of the sleeping car porters, the first black union. And it is, I'm going to tell you, to me, it's more significant than Martin Luther King, as significant, I should say, as Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. But he lays out why that march 58 years ago, to the date, took place August 28, 1963. So they were dealing with Jim Crow. Today, we're dealing with James Crow Esquire. It's just a sophisticated version of Jim Crow.
Is there, in order to get this passed, because this is not a budget bill and this doesn't have to do with the Supreme Court justice, as you correctly point out, there are those two holes have been drilled in the Senate rule. And by the way, this is not a law, and this is not in the Constitution. It's simply a rule of the Senate that can be changed with a majority vote of the Senate, 50 senators plus Kamala Harris. They can change their own rules. But because this rule still exists, this filibuster rule still exists, all it takes is one Republican senator to say, I object. Yeah. They don't even have to say it out loud. They can send an email to Chuck Schumer to say, I object, and suddenly the Democrats have to come up with 60 votes to overcome this. Have you heard that there is a particular Republican senator who intends to filibuster this?
Yes, I interviewed Congressman James Clyburn, and he explained that to me just like you did, and he believes that is it Murkowski from Alaska? Apparently has signaled him that that she would be in favor of doing just that. Now,
of filibustering it or of changing the rules?
Of changing the rules.
Oh, that's consequential. I mean, it'll take 10 Republicans to make that. Well, actually, no, it would only take... Because the only block we've got right now is Sinema and Manchin. We need two Republicans.
Yeah. And so now, again, and that's why he is confident. Now, he expressed his confidence on my show earlier this week. I think I had him on, it was either Monday or Tuesday, but
oh, that's great. And
he expressed confidence that that would happen, and he deliberately mentioned her.
Yeah.
He thinks that she might be the one to flip.
That would
but
be great.
Again,
we need one more.
You know, to be honest with you, the maneuvering can be confusing, Tom, to us.
Oh no, I get it. Hey, Joe, I'm 30 seconds away from a hard break. Is there a website? Give people the information they need to participate.
Well, yeah, you can go to National Action Network, .org, or you can go to our social media. We've got everything
Joe
up
Madison.
On our social
com.
Media. Yeah, and whatever, you know, the other social media outlets that we have. So it's all there. Everybody start gathering. McPherson Square, Washington, D.C., and we're going to say show up, speak up, show up and act out, put Biden, the Democrats, on notice. You owe us this one. You owe us.
The great Joe Madison. Joe, thanks again for dropping by. It's always wonderful having you on the program. Great talking to you. Thank you. Kino in Lakeland, Florida. Hey, Kino, what's on your mind today?
Well, good morning. Green greetings, I say. I'm the moose herder, and that gets it in my Google file if I say that.
Okay.
But today, I want to connect a new book by Noam Chomsky, which is called The Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal, which he wrote in collaboration with an economist, Robert Pollan. And then in the Wall Street Journal on August the 12th, one of their columnists, Mr. Daniel Henninger, opened the door for debate and discussion when he said, let's consider and think just for a moment that the United Nations Red Flag Climate Crisis Report is right. Then that poses a practical political question of how should we mitigate the world's climate challenge? So there is an open door for debate. Number one, I've sent in a response to the Wall Street Journal trying to get some discussion and debate about Mr. Henninger's premise. Tom would like to invite you and people watching to consider getting into the debate, and let's get the Wall Street Journal debating about what we can do to make a deal with this, mitigate this climate crisis. And I challenge Mr. Henninger to do a book review of Noam Chomsky's book and in his column. And, the Wall Street Journal has opened up the door for consideration of discussion. Now, his article was called The Democrats Will Ruin the Climate. and it said the Democrats just want to use a lot of money for taxpayers' money, and they want to micromanage people's lives by telling them they can't have cars and they have to ride buses and stuff like that. So I think it opens the door for a good debate in the newspaper of the big business of the United States. What do you think, Tom? Could you are you aware of Mr. Henninger's article, August the 12th?
I am not, Kino. I gave up my subscription to the Wall Street Journal some months ago. It was getting, you know, way too right wing for me.
Yes, I agree. It's most of their climate stuff is all this denial stuff.
Yep.
But Mr. Henninger has opened up the door, and he said, "Let's just for a minute think that it is true." So what should we do? So let's challenge him.
Well, I think you're doing it. You're walking through it, and if you're a subscriber to the Journal, you know you can comment on these articles, at least some of them, and I encourage you to do that. Kino, I have a question for you. You know, you've been calling into the show for years as the Moosehead Republican, the guy who is going to try to return the Republican Party to, you know, something, some semblance of, you know, Dwight Eisenhower rationality, respectability, you know, cautious,
exactly,
but, you know, straightforward and still in favor of a better America. And I know that you gave that up in the last few months, figuring that the Republican Party was irredeemable. What has happened to your movement, and what's your current thinking on this?
Well, I want to get the Green Party to be more oriented toward doing the business that gets the things in place that needs to be done.
But that's just going to help the Republican Party, Kino, because the Green Party will pull people away from the Democratic Party, and then you'll get more Republicans elected.
No. I want people to sign up at the Green Party and not have a presidential candidate, perhaps, but be in
coalition. Why not have them sign up? Why not have them become part of the Democratic Party and promote green values?
Because have a few people in the Green Party that are pushing the priority of the things that need to be done to avert.
Well, I get that at the local level. I'm a big fan of the Green Party at the local level, but you know, it's what I've seen in the Green Party at the national level can be, well, whatever. I'm not going to tell you how to do it. Kino, it's always great talking with you. I really admire your activism all these years and your willingness to understand what's really going on in the world. We don't always agree, but I honor it. Kino, thank you so much for the call. It's great to hear from you. We'll be right back.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Our book today in the Tom Hartman Book Club is R.I.P. GOP, How the New America is Dooming the Republicans by Stanley B. Greenberg. This is from the introduction. This book tells an amazing story, and if you hadn't seen what happened to America over the last 4 years, you wouldn't believe it. It even has a happy ending that's none too soon for all of those of us who've had enough fighting, division, and enough politics. This time, the end of politics portends a country united and finally liberated from gridlock to address the nation's most serious problems. It ends with the death of the Republican Party as we've known it, while the survivors work to recreate the party of Lincoln, relevant for our times. It ends with a Democratic Party liberated from the nation's suffocating polarization to use government to advance the public good, as the country used to expect. You see, our country is hurtling toward a new America that is ever more racially and culturally diverse, younger, millennial, more secular and unmarried,
with fewer traditional families and male breadwinners, more immigrant and foreign-born who are more concentrated in the growing metropolitan areas, which are magnets for investment and for people. The new America encompasses a vast array of family types and working families in which both the men and women face growing challenges. The new America is ever more racially blended and multinational, more secular and religiously pluralistic. The new America embraces the country's immigrant and foreign character. It now includes the college-educated and suburban women who want respect and equality in a multicultural America. America was shaped by major social movements, civil unrest, political battles, and government action at historic junctures, and by the choices the two national political parties took that created a more modern America. Each moved America away from traditional strictures on blacks, women, and immigrants. Each juncture made America freer, more equal, and more democratic. With the Democratic Party on a trajectory that aligned Democrats with the country's emerging civic norms and alienated the Republican Party from the country and from itself. America was changed profoundly by the battle to pass the civil rights laws that ended racial segregation and ensured blacks had the right to vote. Bipartisan immigration laws reopened the country to non-Anglo-Saxon immigration in 1965 and greatly expanded it in the late 1980s. The Supreme Court put women on a path to greater independence and equality when it declared in 1965 that women have a right to privacy and birth control, and in 1973 when it made abortion legal. And these different choices came to fruition with the election and re-election of Barack Obama, the first African-American president whose activist government produced a Tea Party movement and revolt that accelerated the polarization of the country and made attributes about race and immigration matter as never before. The Tea Party and Donald Trump battled to stop history and stop government. At each juncture, the Democrats were deeply divided, sometimes more than the Republicans. This was true on matters of civil rights, immigration, and abortion. Nonetheless, after these defining social issues were settled in law or by the U.S. Supreme Court, national Democratic leaders embraced and defended the social changes and new freedoms that aligned the party with a modernizing America and its values. After more than five decades of such choices, the Democratic Party is associated with equal rights, equality, gender equality, tolerance, openness to diversity, and more. The Republicans' electoral base was in the South and later in the Appalachian Valley and rural states across the country. So at each juncture, they escalated their battle against these national changes. The party's national leaders ignored their own deep divisions and worked inventively to show they were champions of white people during the battle over civil rights and affirmative action. Its leaders scorned the sexual revolution and championed to this day a constitutional amendment to make abortion illegal. They were opposed to women breaking free of the patriarchal family and winning equality. They mobilized against illegal immigration in the states and nationally, fueled by Patrick Buchanan's three campaigns for president. Newt Gingrich led a revolution in the early 1990s that put the GOP into a total war footing against the Democratic Party, determined to expand the liberal welfare state and marginalize conservatism. But those forces defeated him. The Tea Party led the GOP's life and death battle against President Obama and his Affordable Care Act, fueled by Tea Party protests that elevated white racial resentment and hostility to immigrants. Defeating and delegitimizing President Obama was the last chance to stop the new America from winning. Obama's 2008 election, the Wall Street bailout, and the searing battle to pass Obamacare produced the Tea Party revolt and the Tea Party wave election of 2010, the most consequential election of our lifetime. It gave the Tea Party-fueled Republican Party effective control of the U.S. House and Senate, two-thirds of the governorships, and more than 60% of the state legislative chambers, which rushed to radically redraw the legislative and congressional maps to ensure big GOP majorities for a decade. The Tea Party-led GOP pushed the country into fiscal austerity and to deconstruct government, to stop Democrats from using government for positive ends or paying off its growing coalition with new entitlements. The book RIP GOP.
In Hawthorne, California. You wanted to talk about the recall going on in your state? It's starting to get serious,
Tom,
here.
Tom, I'm putting out an emergency call to all California voters to respond with a no vote on the recall of Governor Newsom.
Yep.
Trump and his minions are gunning for our governor.
Well, not just your governor. They also think if they can get a Republican in that governor's position, then they're going to go after Dianne Feinstein and try and force her to resign so they can replace her with a Republican and take over the Senate. And she's 88. I mean, they may succeed.
Right. Well, they're gunning for our governor, especially Larry Elder, the talk show host and mentor of Stephen Miller.
Yep. And he's all over right-wing talk radio, all over California.
Absolutely. Know that this is a very close race, and every vote is important. The wolves are dressed in sheep's clothing, saying that things won't really change.
Yeah.
Don't believe them. We could lose the years of progress that we have made with those who care about the people of this state.
Yeah.
And not just with big business. Mail your ballots by the end of next week. Vote no on the recall.
There you go. Mail your ballot today. Pat, thank you very much for the call. Chris in Littleton, Colorado. Hey, Chris, got a minute here to the break. What's up?
Yeah, the virus has killed more people than any war. The virus knows no borders. The U.S. has a choice: protect patents and mega profits of billionaires and let it rage out of control around the world, or suspend the patents and let the entire world produce billions of doses of vaccine to end the virus.
I'm with you. That's why I mentioned SARS and MERS. I mean, you know, it's, I think we need to
profit or end the pandemic and save millions.
Right. And possibly save us from this virus mutating into something that's more like the original SARS viruses, which is even more deadly than the one that we're dealing with. I'm with you, Chris. I am absolutely with you. We need these TRIPS waivers and we need them now. Chris, thank you very much for the call. Back with your calls on whatever you'd like to talk about. California recall, Supreme Court, flying saucers, pigeons, your choice. We'll pick it up.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say no. The Supreme Court was so wrong on that. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And picking up your phone calls, George in Garden City, Kansas. Hey, George, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom, one thing I'd like to see happen is if the government decides to send out another stimulus check, make one of the rules of eligibility is proof of vaccination to receive your $2,000 stimulus check. Yeah. And that's the only comment I'd like to make. Thank you, Tom.
Well, you know, I think that... I don't object to that, George. I think it would be difficult to enforce, but I am fully expecting, now that this vaccine is approved, that probably, typically the insurance companies come out with their new rules, as it were, you know, in October, because they've got that open enrollment period of mid-October through mid-January. I'm guessing that you're going to see health insurance companies and maybe even life insurance companies say, not unreasonably, we are going to start rating people the same way we do with regard to the use of tobacco. If you use tobacco, your life insurance policy is more expensive, if we'll even write one for you. If you won't get vaccinated, ditto. If you use tobacco, your health insurance policy is going to be more expensive for you. If you're not going to get vaccinated, ditto. I'm fully expecting that. So, you know, we'll see how it shakes out. But, George, keep thinking. That's a good one. I appreciate the call. Charles in Miami. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Hey, Charles.
I'm calling because I'm thinking, like, what about the Afghan soldiers' point of view? It always hears three sides to one story. And my thing is, basically, Trump our only ally in Afghanistan, which was the Afghan government. who in part was employing the soldiers, and how in the world did our military didn't know that the Afghan soldiers weren't paid for at least 3 months, you know, and they're walking out the door and they're thinking, well, these Afghan soldiers are going to support, you know, us through our exit. You know, something is wrong with that picture. And as far as the Afghan...
Are you sure of that, Charles? I didn't realize that this corrupt Ghani government, where Ghani flew to the United Arab Emirates with, what was it, $169 million in $100 bills stuffed into his airplane? I didn't realize he wasn't paying his army. Are you sure about that?
No, yeah, definitely. We've heard accounts where the army wasn't paid for 3 months.
Huh.
I've heard that on different news. Yeah, exactly. Huh. And... what bothered me about all of this and why this came to my mind as far as Afghan soldiers was I was Googling this Afghan soldier and I saw a coward. And that really bothered me. So, you have people that they didn't want, these Afghan soldiers did not, and they probably could have had a chance to sign up with ISIS or the Taliban. But no, they actually probably are people that believe in democracy and wanted a better future.
And over 60,000 of them died. We've lost a little over 2,000, I think around 2,400 soldiers in Afghanistan in the 20 years we've been there. Over 60,000 Afghan soldiers that we know of and can identify have died. The actual number is probably at least twice that.
Right. And this time, they actually took American-supplied airplanes and went to, you know, different parts of, I think it's Turkestan or...
Turkmenistan?
I forget the different names. Right, and a different part of, northern Afghanistan as well, just to get away from the Taliban. So to me, those are the people that still need to be rescued because they did not want to be part of fighting against America. And to me, all this crap that we hear on Fox News, it's just that those people are raging. They've been raging since they lost the election, and they're not going to be happy until they have Joe Biden's head and get to call every Democrat every name in the book. So what we need to do is this. We need to remember Trump is the one who signed this agreement. He let 5,000, somewhere along the line, 5,000 Taliban soldiers who are now, I think, ISIS-K, are now free because of Donald Trump. And they're trying to blame it on us. But let's not forget the Afghan soldiers that refuse to fight ISIS. And what are we doing? And why isn't their story being told as well?
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you. Excellent point, Charles. Sticking up for the underdog. Good on you. Thank you. Susie in Bloomington, Indiana. Hey, Susie, you've got a problem with the bus service there?
Yes. I'm a multiply disabled person, and I live in an area of Bloomington where there are a lot of elderly and disabled people. Mm-hmm. And the city bus service is trying to eliminate one of the routes that we depend on to get to stores, to get our groceries, and to go to doctor appointments in the area. They put their plans on hold until December, but basically they're going to leave us stranded. And I'm trying to bring attention to this issue because there are many people here who will have no other options. They do have a paratransit service. The problem with that is it can be rather cost prohibitive if you need to go out several times a week. And they were trying to tell us that they were going to get us like Uber rides for $1 to go to the grocery store. And I just don't see that. They haven't even talked about that lately. I think that was just some pie in the sky issue.
Do they have regular public meetings, Susie?
They do. And so I'm planning on going to the next Bloomington Transit meeting and a city council meeting.
Good.
I have dealt with them in the past, and I have beat them in the past.
Good.
But the forces are greater, and I get more disabled. I have memory problems, and it's getting harder for me to organize things.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I was hoping to publicize this issue.
Is there
your
a website, Susie, that people who are outside of Bloomington, Indiana, can at least tweet or make their voices heard or make a phone call or whatever? Is there any way for people out of town to?
Yes, they do. Yes, they do have a public comment space, and it's customer customer at bloomingtontransit.com.
Okay.
And their phone number
at bloomingtontransit.com. Okay.
Yes, and their phone number is 812-336-7433.
Yeah, and if you call that number, A, please be a resident of Indiana at the very least, and B, be very polite. I mean, you know,
Yes.
So good on you, Susie. I wish you the very best. Keep us up to date and let us know how it works out. That's activism at its very best. Speaking of activism, Norma in Montgomery, Alabama, one of my favorite activists on the line with us. Hey, Norma, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to let you know that COVID here in Alabama is very bad. We had 5,000 new cases yesterday.
Oh,
we had 50 people die yesterday. Mobile is out of morgue space. We're asking for federal military medical help. The schools are being closed again. You know, we had 111 children in one school with 16 employees test positive last week. You know, this is school's been open 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And this is very bad. And schools are being closed for deep cleaning. And we still have people here having hysterics over wearing a mask.
Yeah.
You know, and you have these people, you're violating my beliefs if, you know, you have gay people walking on the streets. And now these same idiots are saying, you can't force me to wear a mask.
Right.
And it's just...
I know. The sign that I keep seeing at these things, my body, my choice... It's like,
yes.
This is hysterical. You stole that from the pro-choice movement.
Yes, well, we're getting that on our Facebook pages, too. You know, you people say it's my choice, I'm not going to wear a mask. Well, you can keep your hands off of our bodies because you're not female to start out with.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it just, you know, I'm worried about
And then there's
that.
The nudists. It's my choice to wear clothes.
Yeah, well, how about the women in Afghanistan? They're going to have no choice, and they'll be pregnant at 12 and 13.
Yeah,
and
sadly.
And dying on the floor because they're not allowed to go to a doctor.
Yeah.
But, you know, here, though, we've got this hurricane coming in also. People are already evacuating out of Louisiana. And so you have the potential for spreading it even more as people flee and they don't want to wear their masks. They're upset and they're worried about their homes. And you can have, you know, they're talking about this has the potential to be another Katrina.
Yeah. And it's sitting on the anniversary of Katrina, isn't it? Like right to the day or at least to the week?
That was the 25th of August.
Okay, yeah, so it's
yes.
It's the same week.
When it
anyway.
Hit was the 25th.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's supposed to come in Sunday morning, and that's if it continues at the same speed.
Yeah.
But this COVID problem here, thank you, Trump, for being here last weekend.
Oh, geez, I completely forgot about that. Are they able to track it now to Trump's super spreader event?
I don't know, but I think that by the time these people, they've been home now for a week, wherever they came from, Kentucky, Tennessee, Mississippi, Georgia, there's no telling how far they came from. You're going to see even more COVID in the next 5 days.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Norma, keep the faith. Thanks so much for the call, and I wish you the very best there in Alabama.
Today we're reading from the Polar Bear Expedition, the Heroes of America's Forgotten Invasion of Russia, 1918-1919. It's a story, by the way, that the Russians remember well, but most Americans are unaware of. This is from the prologue, Nizhny Gorod, Russia, January 19th, 1919. They've been expecting it for weeks, hell, months, and so the men of Company A to the 339th Infantry Regiment, the Polar Bears, as they would come to call themselves, have stood night and day in 40 below zero temperatures. They stamp their feet and try not to touch bear skin on the frozen barrels of their weapons, lest their flesh be ripped off. They peer through the deep ebony night of their dark log-lined dugouts into the frigid tundra toward the south and east across the ice-choked river and watch for it, wait for it, and wonder how many will come and how they will perform when they do. And they wonder, too, if and how they will ever get out of this place, this frozen Hades, this last place on Earth at the top of the world. And then early on this morning, they do come, a horde of them, dim forms in the distance spread out across the Vaga River, some on skis, others on snowshoes, all of them armed, like ghost warriors traversing the river Styx, hundreds of them to their mere handful of 46. Bolos, the men call them, Bolsheviks. Now a shell flung from upriver, arcing and piercing the barely gray of dawn, flies over the village. Lieutenant Harry Meade awakens with a start, quickly dons his fur hat and overcoat and boots, and races to the far outpost where this scant group of half-dozen men stands guard against not only the enemy, but the tide of history. The sergeant hands him his field glasses and he squints through the misty blowing snow, the only sounds the sharp snapping of frozen tree branches and the dull booming of the river ice cracking. He sees them now, coming on several hundred yards in the distance, and he quickly understands that the company is probably doomed. Now a grayish form enters his view, much closer, and he peels the glass from his eye. Steam comes from his mouth as the thin outpost is now about to be overrun by a nearer group of the enemy, who have snuck closer and rise like dervishes from their concealment in the deep snow. Lieutenant Harry Meade, late of Valparaiso, Indiana, and Detroit, Michigan, stranded more than 200 miles from his regiment's base at Archangel, Russia, doesn't have to speak as the mass of Bolos descends on his small attachment. His men are already furiously firing their machine guns and rifles at this grisly apparition, all while more artillery shells spew over them and land amid them. Meade yells the words anyway, as if by rote, as if it's not too late, as if any of them has a chance. "Fire," Meade orders his men. "For God's sake, fire!" Chapter 1, The March to Intervention. The preliminaries began on March 9, 1918, with millions of high explosive and gas shells raining across the front between the northern French cities of Preuil and Saint-Quentin. The smothering of the British-held territory continued through the week and beyond, and was topped off with a continuous salvo from 6,700 pieces of German artillery, which began at 4:30 in the morning on March 21st. 5 hours later, heavy mortars began raining death and destruction on the British Fifth Army, and 5 minutes later, the advance of three German armies, 69 divisions in all, poured from their trenches and headed east with the aim of splitting the junction of British and French forces on the southern end of the Somme front and sending the Brits in a panic for the protection of the Channel ports. There was an urgency to the assault, and for good reason. With the signing of the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk on March 3rd, Russia had officially taken itself out of the war and relieved the pressure on Germany's Eastern Front. After years of fighting a two-front war, German forces were now consolidated. Meanwhile, the United States, which had declared war on Germany nearly a year before, had yet to send enough men across the Atlantic to tip the balance in the Allies' favor on the Western Front. But the Yanks were coming. During that spring of 1918, therefore, Germany had a small and unique window in which to act. While the numbers favored them, and so the hand-picked assault troops went forward in great and deadly haste. Above the attackers, 326 fighter aircraft soared into the morning, their opposition just 261 British planes. Following barrages, small teams of stormtroopers appeared out of the deep fog and, ignoring the British strong points, cut swaths through the trenches with light machine guns, automatic weapons, and flamethrowers. By the end of the first day of what would be a months-long offensive, the Germans had pushed more than 4 miles through the British and were still advancing. In their wake, they left the bodies of an untold number of defenders, thousands of wounded and 21,000 prisoners. By March 23rd, three huge guns made by the arms manufacturer Krupp had been hauled forward and began sending shells into Paris, 72 miles away. 200 Parisians would be killed on that day alone. Those unlucky Parisians would be but grains of sand in an ocean of war that had enveloped France since August of 1914, when a gray tide of Germans had pushed across the border with Belgium and by early September had very nearly taken Paris. The flood was checked on the Marne River east of the French capital in early September, but the war, it would eventually become known as the Great War, had only begun. The Germans intended to stay, and by the end of 1914, a dizzying series of parallel zigzagging trenches, French, German, and to the north, those of France's British allies, scarred the French soil, the Polar Bear Expedition.
And welcome back. Trying to see who's been on hold here longest. Mike in Elyria, Ohio. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Elyria to the best service class in America.
Elyria, okay. What's up?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. At your age, you know, we're both within a year of each other. And I read the obituaries. And a suburb made about 2 miles from us, just had a Sturgis rally death.
Really?
Yes, sir.
Somebody just died just down the road from you that you can track back to Christy Noem's service, Sturgis super spreader event.
Well, I read the obituaries, and in the obituary it says that this gentleman loved Harley Davidson's, and he was at Sturgis. So.
Wow. Wow. It's so unfortunate.
It's on our doorsteps.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And it's happening all over the country. So that was what you wanted to share with us, Mike?
Yeah, and I'm waiting for your book. It's on order, so.
Oh, on healthcare? Yeah, that should be out next week.
I'll have them all, have them all, except for the new ones coming up, so.
Okay, well, thank you. I hope you find it of value, and when you have a chance to read it, you give me a shout. Thank you very much.
Oh, I do.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. Good talking to you. Jeff in San Francisco. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
I just want to reiterate something that Morris was bringing up. He says, talking about buying out companies, like oil companies.
Mm-hmm.
We could, for $321 billion, we could buy the top 10 biggest ag companies in the country.
Really?
And then, I added up, Archland Midland's one. That's only $35 billion. So about $320 billion, we could buy them all out. Then we can make reparations to African Americans, give them each 10 acres and a little small farm, or maybe 40, they're ripped off in the first place. And we could, with the Green New Deal, then we could leave a lot of that land for, because the big part of the climate change is the deal with the, how we plant. So we leave fields, we plow them up. That would be great sequestering of carbon.
Right.
And we could also start the CC program again, and we could put people to work planting trees. And I'm crazy. I think we should have a bike lane across the country with little charging stations for electric bikes. I know that's pretty out there.
That's kind of cool. Louise, when we lived in D.C., Louise had an electric bike, and she tooled all over the city on it. It was, one of these pedal bikes. You pedal it most of the time, but if you're pushing up a hill, you push the button, and you get an electric assist, and it's really cool.
Yeah, I'm getting older. I like biking, but I can't do what I used to. But it'd be kind of nice to, they're pretty popular in the city here, too. And you can have little charging stations, a little trip across America, and even make them with recycled plastic that we give people permanent jobs, with a guaranteed federal job. And, just little thoughts on something we can do with, if we bought out these, money is speech. Let's use our speech and buy these companies out that are destroying our planet.
Yeah.
And at the same time, save the planet.
So, yeah, one of my solutions in this new Hidden History of American Healthcare book is to buy out the health insurance companies. That would be in the neighborhood of $1 trillion. I had no idea you could buy out all the ag companies for $333 billion.
Well, that's just the top 10.
The top 10 are probably a good chunk of them. That's fascinating.
That's
Jeff,
true.
Thanks. Some good ideas out there. We need to put them into place. You stick around. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. With higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. It's accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/Hartman with two N's. netsuite.com/Hartman. That's netsuite.com/Hartman.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. but you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
And welcome back. We're talking, all kinds of things, whatever's on your mind. Bob in Rockford, Illinois. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Good afternoon. I've been reading a book that was written by Carol Leoning, who is an investigative reporter for the Washington Times.
Yeah, I learned after having her on as a guest or her co-author that it's actually pronounced Leonig, but it's spelled L-E-O-N-I-G, so I get what you're saying, Bob. Yep.
Yeah. Anyway, the book is called Zero Fail, and it shocks me. I'm 79 years old. I'm a widower, and I want to read this, just this paragraph from the prologue and see.
If it's very brief, Bob, please. We ask people not to read on the air here.
Oh, okay. Well, this paragraph asks about how can this organization, who is one of the worst working environments in Washington and can't hire enough people fast enough to fill the vacancies and can't stop an assassination with stubborn devotion alone. And I highly recommend
What's she talking about there with that, Bob? This organization, what organization is she talking about?
It's the Secret Service.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's right. She wrote a book about the Secret. Yeah, which, by the way, came out of the Treasury Department after the Abraham Lincoln assassination.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I know they started then. But over time, they have been given more and more duties to perform, and their budget has grown from several million to multi-million dollars. And the leaders of the organization are very vindictive if the agents bring something up. So a lot of the agents are silenced by fear of losing their jobs, et cetera, et cetera.
So, Bob, what are your thoughts on how to reform the Secret Service in ways that make it more functional? And I would think if anybody would be concerned about that, it'd be the President of the United States. This is his security detail.
Yes, I would agree. But I think it needs to have a serious look at, a committee and so on. But it's just amazing what the mission of the Secret Service has done over the years and what it has to do to me. And the budget is gone into the multi-million dollars. And, of course, they've had some very poor things that the agents have done. For instance, when Obama was going to South America, they went to the...
they all got drunk and were hooking up with hookers.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, I remember it well.
Anyway,
yep, Bob, I'm hopeful that Carol Lennox's book will produce some change, and thank you for highlighting it. That was excellent. Scott in Charlevoix, Michigan, the town where my parents are buried. Hey, Scott, what's up? Where I used to vacation as a child.
Hey, Tom.
What's up?
Well, I'm going to get a little conspiratorial here. What I think is, to most people, is seemingly insignificant symbolism, I think will be viewed as the most significant symbolism or symbolic gesture to mark the 21st century.
We have a half a minute, Scott. Let's get right to it.
Okay. And that is the GOP and their master classes altering of their logo to flip the stars upside down. I view that as their declaration of war on democracy.
I do, too. They did that in 2000.
A full phrase of fascism. Yep. Yeah, in 2000. And so we're talking about 20 years in Afghanistan. But how about this 20-year war on democracy right here?
Yep.
And, a full embrace of fascism and use of brute force tactics on all fronts.
And I have asked Republican senators, I've asked Republican House members, I asked the chairman of the Republican Party, why did you guys turn the American star, the right side up five-pointed star, into the upside down satanic star on your logo? And none of them have been able to give me a straight answer.
Yep.
I've been asking this for 20 years.
I know. I've been listening to you for about 12.
Yeah, it's just incredible. It's like, why would they do this? Why would they put, and you know, the openly satanic star as their logo? There's three of them on the elephant on their logo. It's their official logo. You can look it up, GOP logo. And the stars are upside down. And, you know, you flip a flag upside down, it's an international distress signal when the stars go upside down.
Exactly.
But, yeah, Scott, it's still a mystery. Or maybe not. Maybe they really are just in league with Satan. God only knows. Scott, thank you for the call.
It's the Tom Hartmann University Book Club. Today we're reading from Legacy of Secrecy, The Long Shadow of the JFK Assassination by Lamar Waldron and me. This is from the introduction. The assassination of President John F. Kennedy on November 22, 1963, triggered cover-ups by officials that continue to negatively impact American politics, life, and foreign policy. Legacy of Secrecy details those cover-ups and hidden investigations, many for the first time, including the reasons they were carried out under such intense secrecy. Most were spawned by John and Robert Kennedy's top-secret 1963 plan to stage a coup against Fidel Castro. A plan so highly classified that it only started to be exposed in 2005 and is fully, finally, revealed in this book. Their own confessions now show that three mafia bosses, Carlos Marcello, Santo Traficante, and Johnny Roselli, were behind JFK's assassination. They used parts of the secret coup plan to kill JFK in a way that forced Attorney General Robert Kennedy, President Lyndon B. Johnson, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, and high CIA official Richard Helms to withhold critical information not only from the public and the press, but also from each other and sometimes their own investigators. It's important to keep in mind that JFK was murdered just a year after the tense nuclear standoff during the Cuban Missile Crisis. The main goals of U.S. officials were to prevent a nuclear confrontation with the Soviets and to protect JFK's ally high up in the Cuban government, Commander Juan Almeida, head of the Cuban Army in 1963, still listed as Cuba's number three official today. While U.S. leaders have managed to prevent a confrontation with Russia and preserve a critical ally in the Cuban government, this limited the investigation into JFK's murder, allowing the three mafia chiefs and their associates to remain free. As a result, the long shadow of secrecy surrounding both JFK's murder and the coup plan set the stage for the murder of Martin Luther King, ultimately driving two presidents from office and bringing about the murders of five congressional witnesses in the mid-1970s. Legacy of Secrecy breaks important new ground in key areas, detailing for the first time Louisiana godfather Carlos Marcello's clear confession to ordering JFK's assassination. Marcello's criminal empire ranged from Dallas to Memphis, and previously secret files at the National Archives have shown that he made this confession in 1985 to an FBI informant ruled credible by a federal judge as part of a secret FBI undercover sting operation named Camtex. Exposed here for the first time, Cantex yielded Marcello's admission that he'd met Lee Harvey Oswald and set Jack Ruby up in business in Dallas. The operation also generated hundreds of hours of heretofore secret prison audio tapes of Marcello discussing his crimes, recorded using the FBI informant's bugged transistor radio. Yet the FBI and Justice Department withheld most of that information from the public and Congress for years until its revelation in this book. Carlos Marcello wasn't the only mob boss who confessed his involvement in JFK's murder to a trusted associate. Legacy also uncovers important new information about Marcello's partners in JFK's assassination, Tampa godfather Santos Traficante, and Johnny Roselli, the Chicago Mafia's man in Las Vegas and Hollywood. Shortly before their deaths, both mobsters admitted their roles in JFK's murder to their attorneys. Two of their associates with documented ties to the secret JFK Almeida coup plan likewise confessed. Using exclusive new information supported by FBI files apparently withheld from Congress, this book names two of the Georgia men who paid James Earl Ray to kill the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, white supremacist Joseph Miltier and Hugh R. Spake. Miltier, who had been involved in Marcello's murder of JFK, was part of a small clique of racists in Atlanta who used Marcello to broker the contract to murder Dr. King. We document James Earl Ray's ties to Marcello's heroin smuggling operation and long overlooked evidence in FBI files linking Ray to Marcello's associate, Johnny Roselli. Finally, this book explains why Ray, while fleeing to Canada the day after killing Dr. King in Memphis, made a 400-plus mile detour south to Atlanta, where he contacted Spake to get help from Miltier. In 1979, the last congressional committee to investigate the murders of JFK and Dr. King, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, concluded, quote, that Trafficante, like Marcello, had the motive, means, and opportunity to assassinate President Kennedy, end of quote from the congressional report. The HSCA had been created in the wake of Roselli's sensational murder, but the HSCA was unable to establish direct evidence of Marcello's complicity. And the same was true for Trafficante and Roselli, because the CIA, FBI, and other federal agencies withheld so many relevant files. The HSCA, headed by civil rights figure Lewis Stokes, also concluded there was a likelihood of conspiracy in the assassination of Dr. King, and that financial gain was James Earl Ray's primary motivation. But they were unable to determine who had paid Ray or how the conspiracy had worked, because the FBI and other agencies had hid critical files. With the help of more than two dozen associates of John and Robert Kennedy, backed up by thousands of recently released documents at the National Archives, many of which are quoted here for the first time, Legacy tells the full story denied to Congress and the American people, Legacy of Secrecy. We'll be back with more of the news and more of my thoughts and yours in this kind of national town hall meeting we have here every day on the Tom Hartman program. And in the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Never was intended to be. It requires you. So get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.